This is the Lancer Radio Network, streaming live on www.lancerradio.org, Pasadena Campus Sounds. And welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Inspiration takes all kinds of forms. And my first guest today has a brand new book in which he explores the idea that in works of classical literature, and some recent classical literature as well, main characters often have their own personal muse, a woman who inspires their actions and inspires them to fulfill their fate. I am speaking today with Dr. Robert S. Oventile, Assistant Professor of English here at PCC. And Dr. Oventile is both the advisor to PCC's Lotus Club, a club for PCC students interested in writing and literature, and the advisor for their publication Blue Nile Lotus, which comes out every year. Be looking for a new copy of that to come out fairly soon. Dr. Oventile previously wrote a book entitled Impossible Reading, Idolatry, and Diversity in Literature. Today we're going to be talking about his latest book entitled Satan's Secret Daughters, The Muse as Daemon. Dr. Oventile, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. How, first of all, did you come to write your book, Satan's Secret Daughters, The Muse as Daemon?
Well, in terms of sitting at the keyboard and typing, about the summer of 2007, that's when the actual writing in earnest began. But this book had a long gestation in me. When I think about it, I think about a course I had here at PCC quite some time ago when I was a student here. Dr. Hertz's British Literature Survey class, and I happened to have the second half of the British Literature Survey with him, the one that doesn't cover John Milton's Paradise Lost. That's covered in the first half. And so I wanted to hear Dr. Hertz on the literature from the first half of the course, and I was lucky enough some friends of mine had taken that class and taped his lectures, and his lecture on John Milton's epic poem Paradise Lost stuck in my mind, and then I transferred to UC Berkeley and was able to take the UC Berkeley version of the first half of the British Literature Survey and read Paradise Lost for the first time. And I remember in my dorm, I spent the whole night reading the book. It's about a 500-page poem. Once I started reading it, I could not stop. And it's a central book in my book, Satan's Secret Daughters. So Paradise Lost, stuck with me, you know, over the years. And so in about 2004, I started to think about Paradise Lost again, and thinking about the muses in that poem started me to ask myself, well, who is Satan's muse, and why does he have the muse he has? It turns out in Paradise Lost, his muse is sin. And then my around 2007, I had a chance to start to think I could write this book, and that's so. In 2007, the actual writing started, but the process went back, the thinking process, you know, went back many years.
And did you start with writing about Paradise Lost, which is about, I think, the third or fourth chapter of your book?
Well, you know, the first chapter that I completed was the chapter on Homer's Iliad. And maybe the reason for that is in Paradise Lost, Milton, he models Satan's muse sin on Athena from Homer's Iliad. And so I thought, well, I should really get back to Homer's Iliad and look at how Athena functions as a muse in the Iliad. So I started with that chapter.
Let's define what a daemonic muse is, and then we'll look at how they operate.
Okay. Well, most of us are familiar with the term demon and can probably locate that term in the Bible, in the New Testament. And if we're familiar with the New Testament at all, one thing we know is that Christ, Jesus, he does different things in the course of the narratives of his life in the Gospels. But one thing he's often doing is casting out demons, doing exorcisms, in essence. And so in the New Testament, you don't want to have a demon. You know, if you run into Jesus, he'll say, wait, you've got a demon. Let me cast him out for you. Now, prior to the New Testament, in the ancient Greek world, in the world of Homer's Iliad, there was a term, daemon, which gets into our English translations of the Greek New Testament as demon. For the ancient Greeks, you wanted to have a daemon. For example, the philosopher Socrates, in Plato's Symposium, talks about his daemon. And for the ancient Greeks, there are kind of three levels of existence. You know, there are the mortals, the mortal people, or the mortals, I should say. Then there are the gods and goddesses, and then in between, that's where the daemons are. And so a daemon, if you are possessed by one, it draws you out of your everyday self into a state of ecstasis. Ecstasy. And so in Homer's Iliad, Athena, she functions for Achilles, one of the heroes of the poem, as his daemon. And it's through her that, by in essence, possession by her, it's through her that Achilles achieves his apotheosis as a warrior in the course of the battles described in the Iliad.
Apotheosis meaning high point.
The high point, yes. The high point of his life. There's your regular everyday life. There's your regular everyday self. But at certain moments in your life where you have a day, you have an hour, you have a moment in which you step beyond who you thought you could be, what you thought you could achieve, the ancient Greeks might say, oh, well, that was a lucky day. Your daemon was with you that day. And so in the ancient Greek world, a daemon is something you might welcome. In the New Testament version of such an entity, a demon, well, see, you don't want that in the world of the New Testament. And so the complication in English literature happens when various authors, Shakespeare, Melville, Milton, Sandy Florian, the authors, the principal authors I cover in the book, they have two traditions that come down to them. They have the biblical tradition with the notion of a demon, but then they also have the ancient Greek tradition of Homer, of Plato, that is in the mix. And so the conflict between the New Testament biblical notion of a demon and the ancient Greek notion of a daemon leads to interesting situations, I think, in English literature.
In fact, I observed that reading Satan's Secret Daughters, because in virtually everything I read, a daemon would inspire the character, not necessarily something that would make him happy, but to glory.
True. You know, those can be very distinct things. And the, you know, Aristotle, the Greek philosopher Aristotle might say, well, what you want in life is happiness, and that is achieved through moderation. So that's a slightly different idea than being possessed by a daemon. The ecstasis and glory that can come through a daemon, or at least as Homer narrates the relationship between Athena and Achilles, it's not necessarily about happiness. It is not necessarily about happiness at all. And so these daemonic muses, they can be seen as destructive in a way, because your normal, regular, everyday self, not only might you go beyond it in the ecstasis of possession by your daemonic muse, but that normal everyday self might break apart or be destroyed in some manner in the experience.
We may have to come back to this, but let's begin to look at how these daemonic muses operate and start with Achilles and Athena.
Okay,
what does
well,
she do?
Very good. She's my favorite, I have to admit, right up front, Athena. And you had asked earlier about the genesis of the book for me. Another factor was when I first read Homer's Odyssey, his other epic poem besides the Iliad, I had the strangest experience whenever Athena showed up in the narrative. I felt a particular elation and sense of well-being when I would read passages where she was involved. And now her presence in the Odyssey is a little less drastic in a way than her presence in the Iliad. The Iliad opens up with the Greeks at Troy, having sieged the city. A Trojan has made off with Helen, and the Greeks want to get her back. And the fighting has been going on for some time. And Achilles gets insulted by some of his fellow Greek warriors and says, "I'm done. I'm not going to fight anymore." And part of that process, Achilles has to decide, am I going to, rather than fight the Trojans, fight these fellow warriors that have insulted me, Greek warriors? And Athena steps in, comes down from the clouds, in essence, and stops him. And then he sits out the Trojan War for most of the Iliad, until it's time for Athena to inspire him to go back into the battle and achieve his glory as a warrior.
And I'd like to have you tell me how when we come back. You and I are listening to Dr. Robert S. Oventile of PCC English Division. We are talking about his new book, Satan's Secret Daughters, The Muse as Daemon. We're going to be back with more about this in just a moment here on Lancer Radio at lancerradio.org. This is the Lancer Radio Network, streaming live on www.lancerradio.org, Pasadena Campus Sounds, and this is Dot Cannon with Over Coffee, today talking to Dr. Robert S. Oventile, assistant professor at our English division, about his new book, Satan's Secret Daughters, The Muse as Daemon. And Dr. Oventile, we're just talking about how Athena functions as Daemon to Achilles in the Iliad. You said that she kind of inspires him when he says, "I'm not going to fight anymore." She says, come on, you got to go back. What happens next?
An intense situation for Achilles. He has learned that he has two possible fates. The fates have deemed that he could leave the battle at Troy and return to his home and live a long life and a long and enjoyable life. That's one of his fates. His other fate is to battle the Trojan champion Hector, now defeat Hector, yes, but himself die very soon after. The implication is almost to die immediately after, even though he does not die immediately after that event in the poem. His death is something he will have to face very quickly. So you can imagine that's a dilemma. And so there's a certain resistance within Achilles to returning to the battle after the insults he's faced from his fellow Greek warriors. That's one resistance. But there also is the resistance of going into the arena of your last acts or your last act, Achilles' battle with Hector. And so towards the end of the Iliad, it is the climax of the Iliad, Athena comes to Achilles and inspires him to go out to battle the Trojan champion Hector. And this inspiration of Achilles, it's the overcoming of a reluctance within himself to enter this realm where he will finally become who he truly is, or who he's truly fated to be, a grand and glorious warrior. So the realization of self through the daemon's inspiration comes at a cost, often the cost of entering into an irreversible situation where one's own demise is at the horizon. And so it's a... this would be another way in which the Muse as Daemon it's not exactly about happiness necessarily.
With that in mind, and the fact that sin is modeled on Athena, and she is the muse of Satan, how does she lead him to his fate?
Well, so John Milton, in his epic poem Paradise Lost, he is a fairly ambitious individual, and so he wants to outdo Homer's Iliad as Homer's Iliad for Milton is one of his principal rival poems. And so Milton, in his Paradise Lost, you might notice from, you know, if you look at the title Paradise Lost, Milton's poem, it's about the Christian or the biblical paradise that Adam and Eve inhabited and the loss of that paradise. So Adam and Eve, it's a retelling of the Adam and Eve story, basically, Paradise Lost. Now in Genesis, the Adam and Eve story takes up 2.5 chapters, maybe, of Genesis. Milton fills in all the complex backstory with the war in heaven between the angels that remained loyal to God, the war between those angels and the angels that sided with Lucifer, or Satan, as he's later known as. So sin in Paradise Lost, modeled on Athena. Now, Athena, she was born out of the side of Zeus's head. And so Milton, he takes that idea, and there's Lucifer. He's in heaven. He was the brightest and highest angel. But then another fellow came along, Jesus, and God said, well, you know, Jesus is now going to be my main man. He's going to be the one in whom my glory is most reflected. And so this is a great wound to Lucifer's pride, he having previously been the one who would think to himself, God's glory is most reflected in me. And so the wound to his pride sets off a process within him in which sin germinates. She gestates within him, and in heaven, he, in his decision to rebel against God, she is born out of the side of his head and becomes his muse in his struggle to take revenge on God.
Tell me a little bit about their interaction.
Well, you know, in her, she sees himself. Satan, in sin, sees himself and falls in love. And so in heaven, Satan and sin have an incestuous relationship. She's basically his daughter. And out of that union is born death, eventually, in the poem. And one of the interesting things I think in the Paradise Lost is that Milton, in his rivalry with the Iliad, part of his attempt to overcome the Iliad involves him in a kind of demeaning of characters from the Iliad. And so even Satan is a grand character in Paradise Lost, is in a way a heroic character. But within Paradise Lost, Achilles gets, in effect, demeaned as Satan. Athena, who in the Iliad is she's the most glorious of the gods, the initial lines of the Iliad suggest, the gods and goddesses. She's, overwhelming and awe-inspiring deity in the Iliad. In Paradise Lost, in effect, Milton demeans her in remodeling her as sin. And so the intimate and, in effect, secret relationship that Achilles and Athena have in the Iliad becomes this intimate and secret relationship Satan and sin have, and it's in Paradise Lost. Satan has bit off a little more than he can chew in challenging God for supremacy in heaven. He and his angels are initially defeated. They are cast out of heaven. They fall and fall and fall and fall and land in a place that then becomes hell. Satan says, well, I'm not done. I'm still going to try to take revenge on God. There's this new place, the creation earth, where Adam and Eve are. I'm going to try to get there. And by ruining Adam and Eve, I will take a kind of indirect revenge on God. And so another role that sin plays in Paradise Lost is to facilitate Satan's journey from hell to earth. There's the gates of hell, and Satan, he flies from hell through chaos and a difficult journey, but he gets to the gates of hell where, unknown to him, his daughter landed, or that's where she's been assigned to be, to keep the gates of hell with her son, Death. And after an initial misrecognition, Satan doesn't recognize her initially. She has to tell him, "Don't you recognize me? Hey, I'm your daughter, Sin." And then he does recognize her. She agrees to open the gates for him, allowing him to get to the creation earth, the Garden of Eden, and then. Through various deceits and manipulations, tempt Eve into eating the forbidden fruit and bringing about her and then Adam's fall.
And then, of course, Sin has now helped function as demonic muse because she has sent Satan to his fate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as for Achilles, you know, drawing Eve and then Adam through Eve into eating the fruit is a kind of apotheosis or glorious moment for Satan, but he ends up as a hissing demon eating the ashes of a falsely presented fruit that God arranges for him in his final serpent form to have a very ironically eats fruit that just confirms his confinement to his own hellish self-consciousness. So it does become a parallel to Achilles. Again though, with Milton kind of demeaning and through demeaning Achilles through Satan, however glorious Satan is at points in Paradise Lost.
I'd love for you to give me a quick look also, and I'm sorry that we're running out of time, but can you give me a quick look at the Master Builder and in what way Hilda functions as Solness's demonic muse?
Well, the in Ibsen's poem, The Master Builder, who Ibsen dramatizes in that play an architect who is reaching the end of his career and is wondering how he's the master builder. He's the head architect in his town, in effect, the only architect in his town. He's wondering how longer he can hold that position. There are younger architects to be that are challenging him in his position. And he ends up... Earlier in his career, Solness had built a church and with a tower and had to kind of celebrate the completion of the building, had climbed the scaffolding still around the tower to place a wreath at the top. And at this ceremony, the town, most of the town had gathered. There were a gathering of students. Among them, the young Hilda Wangel, who is struck and herself inspired by seeing this architect climb this tower. This is 10 years before the time of the play. We learn these events through the course of the play. And Solness has occasion to meet Hilda that 10 years ago and promises her a kingdom. And so at the in the present time of the play, it's sort of something he would say to a student who was there at the who he met, but she takes it to heart that he will bring her to a kingdom. And so 10 years later, at the time of the play, she returns to Solness's town and demands her kingdom. Solness is in the process of building a new home for himself with a tower. He suffers from vertigo. There is an ecstasis and a fall for him through Hilda. I will let the curious listeners find out more maybe by reading The Master Builder or attending a production.
Dr. Oventile, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.